Accession number 18018, reel 5.
Heard you pull on reel 5?
Yep. And I was a little bit taken aback because I realised I'd only got about 3 or 4 weeks, possibly a month, 5 weeks remaining in Korea at the most. And if I got involved in a court-martial, which undoubtedly it would have been, I could see myself being there for a rather longer period than that. Sometimes one can make a fairly quick decision, which I did. There were some 6-foot tables piled up in one corner. So I picked one up, and they were so engrossed with each other they didn't hear this happening. So I picked up a 6-foot table and slammed it down as hard as I could on top of another 6-foot table, which was lying flat on the ground. There were some loud yells and squeals and a disappearing act. And a disappearing act underneath the bases of the tents. I thought, well, I think possibly that was the best solution all the way around. A little bit of shock treatment can work sometimes. We ended up in Busan eventually, waiting to get back on board the good troop ship, which purely out of interest, subsequently, turned out to be the Empire Orwell, and gosh, and they stocked it up. Every single goodie and supply you can imagine. Oysters, caviar, they got the lot on board, but that's not quite the end of Pusan, getting on board the ship. Carol Carr show had been on while we were in Korea, up country. And it was laid on at the base depot in Busan. We didn't go along to see the show because we'd already seen it. We'd met Carol Carr and her company. They were a good lot. We'd had lots of laughs together. And this is up somewhere near the front line. We were only too delighted when we got down to Busan to be able to put on battle dress, which we'd rescued from the quartermaster, and able to put creases in the trousers and polish our shoes and look comparatively smart and throw away anything that looked like a rifle or a pistol or anything else. In the rear camp, unfortunately, they decided that as they were in Korea, they'd wear combat kit, carry sidearms, and look very much as though they were ready to go into operations. And there was a feeling of naughtiness that crept through us, rather. And there was food laid out in a buffet and a bar and everything else for after the concert party. And I'm afraid we whipped the lot. Didn't eat it. We whipped it and concealed it in another room. And when the base commander came in eventually at the end of the show with the leading actors and actresses and everybody on their arms, he threw his arms open to present them with a buffet and whatnot to find there wasn't any food. In the interim period, we materialised and were greeted warmly by everybody in the party. And we then asked them if they would like to have anything to eat or drink. And of course they said yes, and we produced all the food. Badly behaved, still there we are. No matter how old we get, I suppose. Grown-up men do behave like little boys sometimes.
I think that you went from the army to the army air corps, did you not?
Yes, well, that was indirectly. in that in Hong Kong, where I was still commanding the 3-inch mortar platoon, I was invited to carry the regimental Queen's colour on our present Majesty the Queen's coronation parade. So therefore I'd be able to see my wife for the first time in over a year, having come back. And I looked, because in the eyes of the army I was still underage to be officially married, like under 25. I looked for a long course, which might keep me in England for a little bit longer. And the longest one I could find was a flying course. I checked it out with the colonel and the adjutant and said it was okay. When I was back on the coronation parade, I'd have a go at a flying course to see if I could stay in England long enough to get me over my 25th birthday, so that subsequently I'd be able to move with my wife with me and have full marriage allowance. This I agreed to. Somehow or other, staggered through the coronation parade, staggered through the flying medical aptitude, staggered through the flying course, where I'm told I used to fly aeroplanes in the middle of the night, waking up with an imaginary control column in one arm and waking up my wife at the same time. However, I made it. And we ended up 25, by this time with daughter number 2, out to Malaya for the emergency. Malaya. Oh dear. Hot. Humid. We were never, somehow or other, we never seemed to make money go round in Malaya. There always seemed to be that much too short. I'm not sure why, but it always seemed to be like that. We never got a quarter, which would have helped. Went up to Kuala Lumpur, where my wife stayed, and I joined 1911 flight, flying Austers, 6s and 7s, in Bento.
How do you spell Bento?
Bento, B-E-N-T-A. Bento is right in the middle of the country. If you draw a line north and south, Malaysia as it is now, of course. If you draw a line north and south, east and west, where the lines cross, that'll be Bento. There's an airstrip, a sunken road, and a planter who lived on the other side of the road, like he was a dipsomaniac. He'd go through all the states of being inebriated, like jolly, morose, bellicose, and eventually either collapse or being escorted upstairs by Cookie. He suggested, I didn't know this at the time, but having knocked his wife down in the middle of the planters club on one particular night and two of her teeth out at the same time, because she was dancing rather over fondly, as he thought, with a young seconded UK officer. So she left with the girls back to England. He suggested Screwball, my wife, might like to go out and run his house for him. And lo and behold, up sticks from Kuala Lumpur, a pretty crazy drive across country, with Monique, eldest daughter, being violently sick through one window of the car. Armour, Screwball, Mandy, and the Sykes driving. Settled in at Benta. We had about, 5 months, I suppose. Six. Screwball, my wife, was the only white girl within a radius of miles. The nearest girl was Meg Richter, Australian wife. Of a rubber planter. The other centre of civilization was Kuala Lipis, some 7 miles away. And if Meg and Screwball wanted to go shopping, they had to have an armoured car in front and behind the vehicle they were in. There was quite a few adventures knocking around in Benta. And we eventually moved down to Singapore, where I found various places to live, and we settled more or less in one concrete slabby type place where we hired the furniture. But my main operating centre was in fact in Kluang, even though we were based in Singapore. The emergency is still going pretty well full strong.
Which years are these about? Years are these?
This will be 56. 55, 56. We found various clearings using the osters, and the biggest one and the real beaut of the whole tour, by chance I stumbled on a clearing which was very close to Kluang. It was only about 4 miles into the jungle from Kluang, which is quite a major place. Where there's lots of platforms and bashers knocking around the place. And it crossed with very good police intelligence that there was going to be a dirty great meeting there with some of the leading Chinese communists who were organizing the terrorists. So we kept an eye on it, and the intelligence was that good. We knew which date it was going to be held on. We avoided flying over it because we didn't want to put the wind up anybody. But we had made a mental note of the jungle pattern so we'd be able to pinpoint it. The idea was, there was a friend of mine, not a pilot, John Tai, and myself. We'd take 4 flares each, parachute flares, and I'd drop them at the beginning and the end of the clearing, basically sort of east to west. If I had a hang up with the flares, John, who'd be right behind me, would drop his. And if I dropped mine, he'd drop his, what the hell, anyway. To give a good marker for a large, organized airdrop. We were going to drop in a pattern bombing, to the degree that they formed a block of aircraft bombers, each with a 1,000-pound bomb, which they would all drop at the same time, which means they would cover quite a large area of jungle. The information as we had it was that the terrorists were going to break up and go their various ways just after 9 o'clock. Therefore, the bombing wanted to be at or just before nine. This meant the various aircraft involved. I can't remember all of them. I think there was George Lincoln, Canberra. I know there's about 20 altogether. Would take off and get into a formation and bomb those from either 3 or 5,000 feet. And they'd be bombing on our flares. We were supposed to give ourselves plenty of time to get away, to drop our markers 2 minutes before the actual drop. But we knew they could run like hell when they wanted to through the jungle, and in 2 minutes they could cover quite a long distance. And so, without telling anybody particularly, apart from the squadron leader who was leading the formation of bombers, we cut it down to 45 seconds. And you can fly a long way in 45 seconds. We made our approach from the east. Sorry. Trouble. We've got a squadron leader, anyone I've met, a meteorological officer. Never met a squadron leader, flight lieutenant, yes, but not a squadron. And he'd been brought up specially for the operation. At 8:15, it was thick fog. John and I knew, we'd been operating out of the area, that it would top at about 800 feet, less, sorry, about 500 feet. And for virtually certain, it would clear up by 9 o'clock. At 9:15, our meteorological squadron leader cancelled the bombs taking off.
At 9:15?
Sorry, 8:15. Forgive me. The squadron leader got onto the ground liaison officer and said, cancel takeoff, or postpone takeoff. Before he could send the message, the squadron leader walked away. I went over to the GLO, who I knew, and said, don't send the message. It'll clear. He said, you realise what you're saying? I said, yep. He said, it'll clear. He said, I don't mean that. He said, that's 20,000 pound bombs that might have to be thrown away. I said, it'll clear. I said, do you want me to put it in writing? He said, no. I know you won't retract your word. We went down to our aircraft at about 8:30. On the way down, it had started to clear. And the squadron leader turned to the GLO, get the aircraft off the ground, get them off the ground. The GLO said, they're on their way. There's a little bit of a dance on the spot. He said, why did you countermand my order? He said, and the GLO said, pointed to me, and as John and I are running towards our horses at the time, given the horses take off, it's clear. We mark the target. It's fantastic. The eruption was really quite extraordinary. 21,000 pound bombs going off from aircraft which have been flying almost wingtip to wingtip. It's really quite a fantastic sight. The whole jungle seemed to erupt. We landed. The first person to get over was the Colonel of the South Wales Borderers, whose boys had also found the camp, or thought they had. We went over, and there's bodies lying everywhere. You can see them on top of sleeping platforms, covered with leaves. He was sort of jumping up and down in the seat in the Austria, and we got down and landed, and as soon as I got down, I was placed under close arrest by the squadron leader for countermanding his order. General Bourne, by this time, had put in an appearance, and I shook him by his left hand, and he said, "Well done," to me and John. And he then heard about the slight altercation between me and the squadron leader. So there was a little quiet aside. He said, "Now I want you two to shake hands," which we did. He said, "And the whole matter will be forgotten," which, as far as either of us concerned, I don't suppose it ever will be.
What rank did you have then?
I was made a captain. It transpired that 17 fairly major communist terrorist operators had been killed.
What was it like flying the Auster under Malayan climatic conditions?
It was all right. The only trouble was during the monsoon season, it could get a little bit hairy. You could get caught up in bad weather, which could overtake you more quickly than you could fly. On one particular occasion, I was coming to Kluang, and it was a big airfield, Kluang. Could land a DC-3 on it quite easily. I was coming into Kluang from the east, and there was this large cloud that was forming. It was building up like crazy, and I pulled all the stops out, full power, nose down, but it still overtook me. It was building up faster than I could fly. By the time I was nearing Kluang, I was in rainfall so heavy that with half flaps for maximum stability and climb and lift, and with a climbing attitude, I was still losing height. I was literally being beaten out of the sky by the mere force of rain. I knew where the airfield was, and I kept on the same heading. And it just scraped over the telephone wires beside the railway line. Got to the edge of the runway and literally went splash, still with full power on. There was a Jeep, Land Rover, came dashing out from the aircrew, who could hear the engine, of course, when I'd come in, and I followed them through, but I was literally taxiing through about 6 inches of water. That much water. It's unbelievable where it could fall down there. It was green, slightly downhill, so it was draining from the airfield.
Was there any danger of your being hit by ground fire?
Oh, from time to time people came back with the odd bullet hell, yes, but frankly, we never really thought about it.
Did you carry anything such as an escape kit if you came down?
Oh, yes. We had machete and survival equipment, which is basically made up of a sort of kit bag, fishing, fishing kit. About 3 days' rations, flares and so on and so forth. Oh, yes, we did. Oh, gosh, I just thought of something, actually. On one particular occasion, thank heavens I'm well out of the service now, because if it had cropped up at the time, it would have been good for the average court-martial. On one particular occasion, I found an active camp, and the Colonel of the South Wales Borderers, I went back, I told the intelligence officer, and there were terrorists knocking around all over the place. They'd got cultivations going, this, that and t'other. Really happy little community. They were miles in. And there wasn't anybody that could go for them. So the Colonel, it got to his ears. He said, let's bomb the buggers. I said, well, actually, we're not really equipped for bombing. He said, how about 7-second fuses on 36 grenades? I said, we're not allowed to do that. I said, there's going to be hell to pay if anybody finds out. He said, who will? So he got about 3 boxes of 36 grenades with 7-second fuses on them. And, well, here we go again. People making like little boys. I was going round and round this blasted camp, and he was hurling 36 grenades up through one side of the ulster. And when we got back, he said, I've not enjoyed myself so much, he said, ever since I've been here. Which, of course, I said, you must never, ever tell anybody. I said, otherwise it's the end of my flying career. He promised he wouldn't.
Do you think it had any results?
As far as they were running around all over the place. Yeah, sure.
So you could see as well as that? You could see as well as that?
We're in about 200 feet.
Did the enemy ever attempt to attack the aircraft on the ground?
No. Not that I know of.
Was the Auster a good aircraft for this kind of work?
Yes, the Auster 9 was better. The Auster 9 was a bit more powerful, better endurance, more comfortable, better equipped as far as radio was concerned, and navigational equipment. They were robust aircraft.
Any other operations you remember in Malaya that you took part in?